Welcome to Delta Cast, everybody. I'm Eric Jackson, here with Mark Blumberg. Hey, Mark.
Hello, Eric.
Thank you for the Manhattans. And we're very excited tonight to have Bob, the Bob McMurray, with us.
Thank you very much.
So where should we start tonight? How about what's pissing you off these days in science? Bob, we're going to start with you because we talk about this too much.
So what's pissing me off right now is the Dr. Pangloss approach to development.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I hate to bring the humanities into science, but they're essential. Voltaire's classic satire Candide has this lovely character, Dr. Pangloss, who accompanies Candide on all sorts of woes and travails. And every time something horrendous happens to this poor young man, he goes, "This is truly the best of all possible worlds, that everything is going to work out well." He has this sort of ridiculous or Panglossian faith in the future that everything is going to work out well. And I think this is something that we see more and more in development, and maybe we've always had it, that the idea that, you know, whatever children are doing, it's for the best. They must be trying to perform some behavior or seek some information because that's what they
and
need.
And this is like a widespread problem in the field of development.
In cognition in general, I think, particularly as we've moved into Bayesian theories, right? Bayesian theories assume that the cognitive system is geared to obtain optimal inference over a set of data, right? To find an optimal model to represent data.
The Bayesian thing has happened for the last, I don't know, decade or so. It's getting popular, right? But what you're suggesting about this Pangloss view predates that?
Yeah, I think in cognitive development, we've seen this since maybe the 80s or the 90s, this sort of faith in the child, that whatever the child does is good, or faith in the caregiver, that, you know, if moms do it, right, it must be for the purpose of helping their child develop, right, to attain better language or to learn some crucial thing about social interaction or to infer the meaning of a word, that parents are just sort of attuned to what their children need developmentally, and that's why they behave, that's why they do what they do.
Well, there must be some reason for everything that they do. That's sort of the idea.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm a parent, and I would say 60% of what I do is, you know, to get these kids to leave me alone or to get them to stop drawing on the walls, right?
Well, that's why social services were by your house the other night, right?
Yes, among other reasons.
You said you weren't going to bring that up tonight.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I couldn't help myself. Yeah.
It's a developmental system. Social services is part of it.
but sure, so, I mean, I'm guessing that this sort of idea has to do with people imagining that there has to be some kind of an evolved fit between the offspring and the mom, and so everybody is sort of doing their role based upon their evolutionary history. Is that where it comes from, or is there something more subtle going
Actually,
on?
I think you're quite right about that. And it's not just evolved in a genetic sense of evolution, it's a cultural evolution as well, right? That caregiving practices evolved because they lead to better developmental outcomes.
But there are enormous cultural differences in parenting practice. Enormous, you know, parenting differences.
You know, that's actually less of a problem. There's some fantastic work on attachment theory, looking at cross-cultural differences in attachment theory. I know how you feel about attachment theory, Mark.
No, I'm attached to it.
You're attached to it. All right, yeah. That's good. Attachment theory is a very important idea, right? It's the idea that children form a bond with their caregivers fairly early in infancy, and that this gives them the sort of security to go off and explore the world, right? Once they know that mom's going to pick them up when they fail, they can crawl across the room and check out that power outlet, right? And this is kind of the hub of attachment theory. Well, back in the early 90s, people started taking the classic tests for whether a baby is securely attached and running it in kids from different cultures. And lo and behold, American kids come out fine. They're all securely attached, you know, maybe 80% of them. But if you take Japanese children...
That has to be wrong.
Well, this is infancy, right? I mean, there's lots of experiences post-infancy that could matter. But you take the same age kids, you test them in Japan, you test kids that were raised on Israeli kibbutzim, you test kids all over the world, and most of them aren't securely attached, right? by our standards, right? Which is nuts, right? I mean, these are all people who are going to grow up to be perfectly fine, or they're going to be normal people. But what they are going to be is they're going to be Japanese, or they're going to be Israeli, or they're going to be whatever their culture is. And it turns out that as people have thought more about this, there's a huge cultural bias and attachment. We have a certain set of standards that we think mean that you're a good kid. It means you're willing to ignore mom and go off. But in an Eastern culture, that's not what kids do. That's also not what adults do, right? Adults have a completely different social dynamic there. So then the idea becomes that, well, okay, fine. We can't use the same measure of attachment with different kids. But whatever parents are doing is helping their kids become better in their own cultures, right? So Japanese moms are doing stuff that encourages their babies to form the whatever kind of attachment they form that helps them be better Japanese social engagers. And Israeli moms are doing that, and American moms are doing that. So cross-cultural differences don't actually challenge the Panglossian view. If anything, the Panglossian view has adapted to embrace that, right? That, yeah, there's different outcomes, but still, whatever parents are doing is helping their children become better adapted to their culture. Sorry for the lecture.
Sounds rather circular, though, right? I mean, Japanese kids become Japanese, American kids become Americans, the parents, it's all just being passed down transgenerationally within the culture, and so kids are like their parents. So what's
amazing?
What's that all about? So what's the issue here?
That's fine, right? As the sort of 60,000 foot view, right? But in daily interactions with your child, the problem is assuming that sort of the parent's overriding motivation is to have a well-adjusted Japanese adult or an American adult. That's what I do every time I interact with my parent. I'm worried about that. I'm thinking about that at some implicit subconscious level. That's the problem. That most of the time when you're interacting with a child, what you're trying to do is, get their attention or get them to eat or maybe teach them something in the here and now, but you're not really worried about their development, right? It's really about, I think most of interactions are very subconscious, and they're really geared to immediate demands, not long-term demands. When I'm talking to my kids, I'm not worried about if they're going to grow up to be good people or if they're going to have 60,000 words in their vocabulary. They ask me a question, and I want to answer it, right? And maybe whatever I'm doing is as good as I can do, which isn't that great, ask my kids, to help them at the moment, but there's really no reason to assume that it's, kind of idealized leading to good development. It's just I'm dealing with what's in front of me at the moment.
Well, let's get back to how a lot of what kids do is just stupid, because that's where we started here, right?
Whoa. Did you just say that kids are dumb?
I did.
This is a developmental center, right?
Yeah. Some of the time.
Are we allowed to say that?
We speak the truth. If the truth is that kids are dumb, then we have to accept that possibility. Is there a problem with saying kids are dumb?
Yeah. I mean, not for me.
So this is what the issue is then, is that the field, you get this overwhelming sense of people in the field almost thinking that it's bad to say some of what kids do is just plain stupid.
Yeah, or caregivers, right?
Or caregivers.
I mean, since the 80s, we've had the generation of developmental scientists who sort of grew up in the post-Spelke years when,
Who's Spelke?
Elizabeth Spelke, who basically showed us that infants can do everything. They have social intuitions. They know about physics. They know about math. They've solved Fermat's Last Theorem, but they can't tell us about it. No, I'm serious. There's a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian crisis lurking in their little social brain. They can't tell us about it. They really have these sort of...
But they can tell Donald Trump, because he obviously knows how to...
If only he would listen to babes.
All right, so post-Spelke.
The field kind of reached this consensus that infants know a lot, right? They have this sort of, Spelke would say, built-in, but we might even, if we want to accept the research... We might just say it was rapidly learned or developed relatively quickly, but well before they can talk, they know all sorts of things about the world. They know all sorts of things about other people. And so there was this sense that babies are, in fact, really smart. And in fact, if you go to the infancy conference, which happens every 2 years, it's where all the infancy researchers gather, you can go and just like count the number of talks that tell you that babies can do something and tally them against the number of talks that tell you babies can't. And the ratio is pretty large. If you can even find talks that tell you babies can't do something, that something has to wait to develop. I'm not sure I've ever seen a talk like that.
I sat through a Paul Bloom talk, and about baby morality, and I haven't yet recovered. I was on a heroin binge for like a month after that talk, just trying to recover from what I listened to.
So which of the university parties has the heroin?
So what's that?
I haven't encountered
that. It was
a
private party. Oh, private party. Private. So
that was in New Orleans, wasn't it?
Yeah, I'm guessing.
I got to go to more developmental conferences.
But I'm guessing that the one of the reasons why sort of the here we are talking about Smokey, why the Smokey thing caught on. It goes back, to Lila Gleitman and all these other folks, right? So there's been a long line of these folks, you know.
There's a team.
Selling this stuff. But it probably goes back to the idea that kids were, before that, thought to be dumb, in fact. That they probably were thought to be completely vacant, you know, little animals, barely could see, barely could hear, certainly can't talk, are completely, you know, dependent. And so these folks came along and said, oh, look at all these amazing capacities that are hidden inside the brains of these children. If only we can, you know, just bring it out of them.
Uncover them,
you know, take off the
sculpture underneath.
Yeah. So in a way, you know, like so many other times in science and different domains, we're just on a roller coaster, and we just happen to be at the peak of the nativist craze, or maybe we've gone over the edge and now we're going the other way now. But
I think we've passed peak nativism, right? I think, you know, there's only so many papers you can write showing that babies are brilliant, right? And for me, and this takes us right back to
I'm not so sure about that, but you know, I guess there seem to be a lot more than we're needed.
I wrote one. That's enough.
Yeah.
For me though, what to get back to Dr. Pangloss, what happened in the 90s, and I think this was very important, but maybe not appreciated for the right reasons at the time, is we discovered that not only are babies brilliant and they know everything, but they've got some pretty amazing sophisticated learning abilities, right? They can learn from just sequences of syllables what tends to happen. They can learn contextual dependencies and visual scenes. Just show them visual scenes. They'll pick up on these contextual dependencies. They can learn to anticipate when a light's going to come on just based on visual contingencies, right? They're very, very smart. And so we realized that babies really have these kind of pretty sophisticated learning capacities, right? That they can, without any teaching, just kind of learning from what's in the environment. And when you put these two ideas together, you get this sort of pernicious thing that the babies are not only sophisticated learners, they're not just like kind of passively absorbing data, right? But they actually are scientists. They're testing hypotheses. And that what they do, their behavior, isn't just behavior. It's not meant to just get mom to smile at me, right? They're testing a hypothesis about how social interaction works.
Actively extracting information from the environment.
So nativism is, in some ways, we have reached peak nativism. That's not the big thing anymore, right? Uh-huh. The big thing, I think, is babies as sort of hypothesis testers, babies as making deep inference using these sophisticated statistical learning mechanisms. I saw a just fantastic talk that scared the bejesus out of me by a very well-known language acquisition person who's from the sort of nativist crowd, the crowd that used to spend their days arguing that babies knew about various aspects of syntax. And he started from Jen Safran's really seminal work on statistical learning, and he rebuilt universal grammar around statistical learning, where Chomsky's ideas of setting the parameters for language, that becomes a statistical learning device that's choosing amongst language models. So again, we don't have like babies now as all-knowing. We have babies as sort of like idealized learners, that everything they do is helping them learn the language they need, or the structures that are going to help them parse the visual environment or social interactions or whatever.
And so what is your opinion of where we're going then in the field for the next 10, 20 years? Is this going to end up anyplace good in your mind?
It's hard to say. I don't know where it's going to end up. There's a small cohort of people I see pushing back a little bit, suggesting that maybe development is a bit more protracted, that maybe it's not all happening by the time you're three, which suddenly starts to look like maybe these learning mechanisms aren't that great. I mean, so if I can talk, can I talk about myself? Am I allowed to talk about myself?
Sure.
Okay. Here's a great example. Back in the 80s, the sort of babies are brilliant zeitgeist in speech perception hit, right? Now, speech perception, the problem babies face, I know you said no bas and pas, Mark, but they...
Sorry.
They have, I know, it's okay. They have to learn what sounds are in their language, right? They have to learn that if I speak Japanese, I don't worry about R and L. If I speak English, I worry about R and L. If I speak Hindi, I worry about da and da. You guys couldn't hear that, but it's
a real difference. I heard it.
Your Hindi listeners could hear it. Yeah. Any Hindi listeners out there? and so forth, right?
Are there any listeners out there is the question, but yeah.
Well, I hope if there are Hindi listeners out there, they also speak English because I don't speak Hindi. And Japanese listeners, I don't mean to imply that you don't have a good phonology. You have a great phonology. But babies have to learn this. And Janet Werker and her colleagues, Richard Teese, her advisor, showed us that by about 12 months of age, babies do. They kind of figure out what sounds they need. And they don't Japanese babies don't discriminate R and L. And Hindi babies discriminate da and da. American ones don't, and so forth. To be fair, I don't think anybody's actually tested Japanese babies. So that's just an example. And all that's well and good, but that kind of creates a challenge because the children then have to do this without any feedback, right? They can't speak. Their caregivers aren't telling them what a bonapa is. They don't have any words. They have nothing. So they just have to kind of analyze the signal using these kind of optimal learning devices. All right. Well, stuff that we've done in my lab, stuff that Susan Nitrauer's done, when you look closely, it turns out they're not done by 12 months. It turns out they're not done by 18 years. That bonpa discrimination is developing through year 18 and probably later. All right. Now that's like, oh wow.
What aspects of bonpa they simply is not learned by 18
years?
Yeah,
exactly. What aspects? Well, they just get better. Not that they don't know what a bonpa is, right? I mean, 18-year-olds know. You guys all know if you're listening. If any 18-year-olds listen, there's a bonpa and they're different, right? But between say 12 and 18, kids get better at coping with all the variation in the signal. They get faster. They can converge on the right answer or the right phoneme quicker. They can ignore competitors. They're more flexible in dealing with different talkers and dealing with different speaking rates. I mean, this is developing all throughout your life, right?
But this doesn't have any impact on the hardcore nativists who are just going to say, yeah, but the ability to discriminate is innate.
They might. I mean, oddly enough, I gave a talk on this, and two other folks, Sarah Creel and Larissa Samuelson, gave a talk on these kinds of things at BU, the BU Language Development Conference, which is the sort of center of nativist language acquisition, and people were blown away. People thought, you know, wow. I mean, they really took notice, which was exciting. So maybe there's a tide turning. But here's the bigger point. I mean, who cares how late this is developing, right? Well, here's the thing. Children get about 17,000 words per day. They get about 4,000 to 5,000 bas and pas per day, right? By the time they're 18, they've heard millions, like something like 17 million. Somebody out there is doing the math, and they're going to tell me it's not 70, but it's close. It's millions of bas and pas, right? And you're telling me that these ideal observer learning models, it took them 18 million tokens to learn the difference between ba and pa? I mean, that's crazy, right? That is clearly not an ideal learning system. That is clearly something that's very slow. And to me, that's clearly a developmental system where kids are paying attention now. They're old, right? They're learning to read. People are telling them about rhyming judgments. People are making them learn lots of words. They're getting feedback. Their brains are developing. So suddenly –
But didn't you just say, though, that like by 12 months of age or so, like the Werker and Teese stuff, I mean, they know the difference before that, right? But they're just getting better at it. So they really don't need, 57,000 whatever.
It depends. I mean, right? You know how to do a derivative, right, Eric? Say yes.
Yeah.
All right. But if I asked you to do one right now, if I asked you, it gave you a polynomial equation and said take the derivative, you couldn't, right? Even though you sort of know the concept.
Give me a piece of paper and a pencil, and yeah.
Oh, this is going to be an exciting podcast.
Yeah, watching people do derivatives.
Okay, go ahead.
Right. But the point is this,
what's
right?
The point?
Is that who cares what you know? It's what you can do, right?
Yeah,
that matters.
Kids can do it.
But they can't. And here's why. Here's what we think that. When Werker and Teese or any baby, I've done this baby work, you when you want to say can you discriminate ba and pa, you play 20 bas and 20 pas, right, in alternating order, and you look for preferences. And you play them at about a ba, maybe one every second, maybe one every 2 seconds. That's not how speech works, right? Maybe you play all from the same talker, right? Maybe you play at the same rate of speech. Speech doesn't work that way. You might, quote, know that there is a ba and a pa when you're tested that way. But if I put you in real speech, you can't do it fast enough, right? And you can't account for differences in talk, or in all senses of the world, you really don't know at that point. You're useless, right? You can't use bon pa in your daily life. And you might say, well, look, all I care about is knowledge. When do they know it? But I think that's the real deep problem in developmental science, is we often just care about what babies know. We really need to care about what they can do. I mean, for example, in our work, we use eye tracking to figure out how quickly these kids at different ages can detect bas and pas and so forth. It takes about, 800 to 1,000 milliseconds for a 7-year-old to fully discriminate a ba from a pa. Well, 800 to 1,000 milliseconds is, 3-4 words.
And then what's the marker? The just some kind of eye tracking?
Yeah, we use eye tracking. It's very complicated, blah, 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 where you can basically watch in millisecond time the decision between ba and pa unfold, right?
But how is it, like... what's the task, for example?
Oh, the task is really simple. You give them a word like beach, and you have them click on the beach, and there's a peach on the screen as well. And you look at when, between the moment that they hear the word and they make their decision, when do they start to make eye movements, right? Because it takes an eye movement in order to plan that response, in order to look at the right object. You've got to fixate there first, right?
And in your mind, that's the ability to functionally use bon pa.
Exactly. If you can't use it to discriminate beach and peach, like, what good is that knowledge? Right? And if you can't use it to discriminate beach and peach in the context of a conversation that, you know, that maybe you're getting 10 B's and P's every couple of seconds, it's no good to you.
But we get better. I mean, so like a kid who's really good at soccer when they're 8 years of age, they're going to keep, they're not going to go to the World Cup. They have to keep improving. So what's the difference? I mean, so what does it matter? I mean, people improve when they're athletes, they improve when they're musicians, they improve when they're dancers, they improve when they're whatever. What makes ba and pa discrimination qualitatively different from the standpoint of theoretically understanding or thinking about development that those other things are not important for?
It's not any different. I think it's the same. I think what makes ba and pa discrimination interesting, if I can call it that, is that we actually can precisely frame the problem. We know exactly, not exactly, but we know roughly how many bas and pas a kid gets every day. We know the statistical distributions of all those acoustic cues. So I can tell you how discriminable they are in the ideal world, right? And kids should have learned this a long, long time ago. They should be really rapid at this.
According
well before
to theory.
They are. According to the theory. According to the input. This is not that hard a task for them to learn. And yet,
the fact that they're not tells you... What? Just that they're not ideal learners, or do you go beyond that and are you willing to say something more controversial?
Whoa. Do I have got some options on the controversy there?
I don't know. No, yeah, go for it. What's the most controversial thing you would say
about bas and pas?
About bas and pas, given like what is the leverage? What is that leveraging you for you theoretically or in your understanding of language development?
I think it says a couple of things. It suggests to me that children aren't just kind of soaking up data and applying the sort of perfect learning mechanism. I suspect deep down inside children don't even know they're learning bas and pas. They're learning words. They're learning to communicate with their caregiver. And bas and pas come along for the ride, right? They're not that important. You know, if you don't discriminate bas and pas, you can do just fine. You can understand a lot of speech. And when you put it that way, there's not a ton of demand on learning bas and pas. Okay, you know. And so it's pretty easy to imagine that this is something that might come along very slowly. Now, the traditional model is the exact opposite. Kids are born into this world. The first thing they do in language is to learn the sounds of their language. Look at any textbook. This is exactly what they say. Once they've got the sounds of their language, they can kind of put them together to learn words. Once they got the words, they can put them together to learn syntax, right? And so every step of the way is geared towards the next step. It's geared toward developmental outcome.
So the linearity of it is partly what's bothering you about this.
Well, but it's not just the linearity. I mean, fine with linearity. It's the gearing. It's the idea that I'm trying to do X so that I can then develop Y.
Right.
Kids aren't trying to do that. Kids are trying to figure out what the fuck is mom saying. I probably should have said it a different way.
That's fine. It was good. It came out naturally.
Yeah,
don't
it came
worry
out.
It.
What
yeah
is mom saying, right? What does she want me to do? How do I get fed around here? My diaper's wet. That's what they're worried about. And they're going to learn whatever it is that helps them get that. And along the way, after millions of trials, they start to realize, oh, wait, my language has a rich phonology. Maybe if I learned it, I'd be more efficient, right? But they're not learning phonology in order to speak. They're learning to speak and listen, and phonology comes along for the ride, right? And I say that as someone who studies phonology. I like speech sounds, right? But what I do is secondary to the bigger problem.
Is what we're really getting at here, though, Bob, your ultimate hatred of the phoneme?
You planned that, didn't you? Didn't you?
That's what it is, right?
Maybe. I mean, the phoneme is a problematic concept.
You hate phonemes?
I hate phonemes
Eric,
as well.
Eric hates phonemes.
You hate phonemes.
I'm going to need another Manhattan before I'm willing to go that far. I've got a lot of friends who like phonemes.
I'm trying to figure out why anybody would hate a phoneme.
Because it doesn't mean
squat.
Well,
there's a place for phonemes.
Does anybody think
in some way, but if we're talking functional right now and going down this road, then there is no place for a phoneme.
There's no place whatsoever.
Okay, so now I have to say, like, what are you guys talking about? Why would anybody be passionate about a phoneme?
Because the stakes are high, Mark. They're very, very high.
That's got to be you're being facetious.
So I'm just going to give my view, and then Bob will give a smarter view, and then we'll go from there. Okay.
I doubt it.
My problem with the phoneme, and I do think they exist in some capacity, right? But in terms of what we're talking about, my problem with the phoneme is that when a kid is hearing a stream of speech signals, right, there is no way that this kid is learning phoneme by phoneme by phoneme by phoneme, because that's just not how physics works. That's like a kid's not going to hear these kind of categorical units from a continuous stream of information. It's just...
And why would you bother?
It just doesn't make sense. Exactly. And why would you... I think it was Carol Fowler that said this. Like, why would you bother, you know, learning the language and then breaking it apart so you could have the building blocks of, or the so-called building blocks of that language? It doesn't make any sense.
Well, so with the visual system, people certainly argue that that's what you do. You break the visual scene down into its component parts. Different parts of the cortex and the visual cortex are dealing with motion and color and orientation, and then eventually it all gets recombined back into its holistic.
Well, it seems like it. So
like there's plenty
to
of
me
people
it seems
in vision
like,
who would say, just like Carol Fowler, why would you do that?
Right.
Why is one thing, but if it's a fact, and I'm not saying it is a fact,
right.
I don't. There are lots of facts, quote unquote, that go away.
Yeah.
But
let me just make one more point, and then we have to get Bob's take on the phoneme right now. I've been looking forward to hearing this from you, Bob.
You better not be disappointed.
It seems
Eric's got very odd taste.
It seems in a lot of ways.
I didn't see this happening. I didn't see the conversation going to hatred of phonemes.
To phonemes. It seems to me that the phoneme exists because it's a way that we as scientists can talk about language. To me, it doesn't seem like it serves any functional kind of purpose.
Well, that's a historical question, right? When people first started talking about language and phonemic context, why did they do it? What was the power of the phoneme for the early
Babylonians, right? Cuneiform was a phonetic alphabet, wasn't it?
I don't know, was it?
I'm pretty sure it was.
You're going to have to tell me.
I mean, alphabet is kinetic, right?
But for psycholinguists or whatever, what linguists, what was the benefit of thinking about the phonemes independently of everything else?
The thing is, linguists have a different job than us, and they certainly had a different job for us pre-Chomsky, right? Their job was to describe the language in a way that you could learn how to speak it, right? Or you could learn how to understand it. And so phonemes are actually pretty useful for that job, right? To say, hey, look, this is a language that it makes two differences. It has a bon, a pon, it has a don, a ta. You better learn that. Or this is a language that has three sounds, right? And so, you know, in terms of like teaching somebody to pronounce a language correctly, you sure as heck better have a phoneme. And so, you know, field linguists, descriptive linguists need it, right? And then you can – once you have phonemes, you can talk about the rules. In German, there's no ga or ba at the end of words. All those become cuz and pus, right? That's a rule that it's not about specific words. It applies to all words, any word that has that sound in it, right? And so phonemes make that job easier to talk about. The rules of the language, to teach it, to get other people to understand it, to describe it.
Sure.
That has literally no bearing to what's going on in people's heads or into children's heads as they're learning it, right? This whole thing came about as a handy way to talk about language for a very practical and, frankly, a very important job of just simply describing the rules of a language. We need that. I mean, we are out there in the world with doing this with endangered languages now, right, to save
I would question the importance, but I'm completely with you.
No, this is important. this is important. The diversity of language really challenges how we think about development. And if we don't understand the way that languages differ amongst each other in various levels, we are going to completely oversimplify the developmental system. You can't, like, describe the phonology of a language, the sound patterns of a language, by just listing all the words in it, listing all the sentences, right? If you want to make it understandable, you're going to have to come up with some rules, and those rules are going to have to work over phonemes. That doesn't – or something else, right?
Well, it's not like what Lamarck did for taxonomy and biology.
Yeah,
he was able to describe a lot of different things and by imply ways in which – or mammals and other animals had to be related to one another, but that gave that was not Darwinian, right? He had no mechanism for why these creatures would be related to one another or anything else. It was purely descriptive.
But it was
very important for evolutionary biology that Lamarck had come along before that.
Exactly. And I think that's what, you know, descriptive linguistics gives language.
Not Lamarck. What am I saying, Lamarck? Oh my God! I'm having a brain.
I don't know.
Do you want to correct the record?
So, I do.
Who is it?
It wasn't Lamarck.
Well, who was it?
Because I'm blanking on his name.
Oh, tip of the tongue.
Let's
phenomenon.
Just both be silent right now and look at Mark until he gets
it. That's horrible.
No, dead air is not a good thing.
All right, keep going. I'll come back. I'll yell it out as soon as I get it.
Okay, you're up.
Where are we now?
So you were describing how it does have its usage.
Yeah, it has purpose, right? Yeah. I actually think it has purpose.
It has purpose.
Linnaeus.
Oh,
Jesus.
That's why you got Lamarck. I can explain that. That's a mixed speech error. Gary Dell, are you listening? Gary, I've got one here live. Put it in your database. If you're not listening, Gary, you should be.
You're talking about Gary Dell.
Oh, of course I'm talking about. I'm not talking about Gary Dell. I'm talking to Gary Dell, if you're out there.
All right, so phonemes, good, bad, indifferent?
All right, so phonemes. I think it's a small-scale debate. It's an important one, and I care passionately about it, and I care about you, Eric. But I think the stakes are small on this one. Here's the problem with phonemes. Phonemes are a unit of sound. Okay, we got to talk about sound somehow. What makes a ba different from a pa? And it has no actual significance in the life of the organism because it doesn't mean anything. You know, you could argue that, well, it describes something.
But it's not a unit of sound, though.
Well, it sort of is.
Like,
it's an approximation.
Like, it can characterize a unit of sound.
Well, sure.
Okay.
But, I mean, no one expects a unit of sound, a unit of anything to be sort of completely
exactly
descriptive,
it,
right?
Sure,
I mean,
sure. okay,
right? I mean,
yeah, sure.
Everything's an approximation. Okay. I can measure your height. It's an approximation, right? A phoneme is an approximation. It's easy to talk about. It's fine. I don't care if it's the right unit or not. You know, I know you guys at Haskins like the dynamics of gestures. I do too. That's wonderful. I've done lots of work suggesting it's down in the level of acoustic cues and continuous cues. That's also a great way to go.
Yeah.
But that's not the problem with phonemes. If you replace it with something else that just is another unit of sound, whatever you want to call that unit, it's still no good. The problem with phonemes is that they don't mean anything. And to let's get back to development, which is what I really care about today. What that means, if you think that children are coming into this world trying to learn the phonemes, is they're trying to learn something that doesn't actually serve them any purpose except for further development. You don't learn ba and pa because you care about ba and pa. Who cares? I don't care about ba and pa, even though I have like 20 papers on it. I know. I know I should stop, right? But they're so good. All those papers, every one of them. Read them all. Gary, if you haven't read them yet.
Man, there's a weird obsession with Gary Dell on this episode.
Wow. Just tonight.
Wow.
Just tonight. But
send a love letter.
But in a sense, we're saying that children spend 12 months of their lives learning something that they don't need right then. Yeah, it'll benefit them later, presumably, according to sort of a phonemic theory of language development. But they don't actually need it to accomplish any immediate goals. It's not going to help them be better babies. It's not going to help them get their diapers changed. It's not going to help them, you know, get a sippy cup, right? They're just learning to perceive phonemes for their own sake. And that's what I don't agree with. You know, babies are not trying to idealize a model of the language. They don't know they're learning a language. They're trying to get their needs met. And a language comes along for the ride, right? Along the way, they discover that this is actually a much better way to get your needs met. It's a much better way to communicate with people. And these sort of idealized learner theories would kind of put the cart before the horse. Oh, we have to have this language. Everything is about learning this language, or learning anything else for that matter. Where I think, you know, you could take it back to associative learning, right? This is the Roscorlo-Wagner model. Animals aren't learning the contingencies for their own sake. They're learning to avoid the puff of air in their eye or the shock on the footplate, right? Connectionist models, same thing. Connectionist models aren't learning a language. They're learning to predict stuff, or they're learning to respond to the feedback contingencies you give it. They're learning to do stuff. They're learning to be good models.
So what proportion of the people in your field listening to that very persuasive argument, well, to my way of thinking, what proportion of people in your field would say, right on, Bob, and what proportion would say you're adult?
Well, they would all say I'm adult.
What field are we talking about?
So, let's talk about psycholinguistics.
The Elysian fields.
Okay, psycholinguistics.
Psychology, people who are psychology, okay. Like language-oriented psychologists.
Well, okay, there's some proportion.
Developmental psychologists.
There's some portion,
because that'll make a difference. But,
who are far smarter than me, and I won't deny it, right, who would say...
Oh, Bob, don't be modest.
No, I am. Yes. I don't understand what some of these people say.
There's no room for modesty here, Bob.
Okay. I do understand it. I just despise it. No, I really don't. There's people out there who would say, hey, you know, you're completely right, and we're Bayesians, and we're already doing what you say. And that actually, that's exactly what these ideal observer-type models are doing. And you
say to that?
I say, I don't get it, and they can't explain it.
You don't get it because you're not smart enough?
That's why, I don't know.
Because deep down, you actually think they're full of shit.
I mean, I've worked with some of these models.
Seriously, Bob, I don't believe you for a second. So you're going to have to be more, either drink more or be honest more.
And I think you think the latter also.
I'm going to take the drinking option.
Yeah. Try it. So I don't believe you for a second. I don't believe that you believe that. So I'm going to push you, and I'm going to demand the truth.
The truth, as I see it.
Yes.
Yeah. I think that some of these theoretical frameworks, I think Bayesian framework, very slippery. I think dynamical systems too, of which I am a proponent, very slippery, speaks very closely to the sort of practicalities and the mechanisms of, say, learning a phoneme, and doesn't have necessarily a very formalized or a very explicit scope of the purpose of what's this for? Why are we doing this? How does the organism fit into this, right? These are often theories of a specific problem. And it gives people who work in these computational and theoretical frameworks the wiggle room to kind of recast it however they want, right? And I don't buy it. I don't buy it, right? I mean, show me the math that says, hey, here is my lovely Bayesian model or my lovely dynamic system that's interacting with the environment, and it's not learning for its own sake. It's learning to be a better organism.
What you're really talking about here is the importance of context, right?
Oh, that's exactly what I'm talking about.
So I do think there are some of us in that sort of dynamical systems world.
Yeah, I knew I
world,
could rub you a little on that one.
That would mostly agree with everything you're saying right now, as you pointed out, right?
Yeah.
But then would also say, like in our models, you know, that is something that we strive to incorporate and to look at.
Absolutely. It is,
yeah.
Right. And and you see models that are good at this, right? I mean, John Spencer and Sammy Peroni here in the Delta Center, right, had some lovely models where they had models that were interacting with each other, right? Or they'd embody their models more about those models are doing it, right?
Yeah.
Although those models also. It's not exactly clear how in John's model, and I'll just pick on John because you're not here. John, are you listening? Probably not.
He's with Gary Dell.
He's with Gary. Oh, wow. That'd be fun.
You know I'm going to have to defend John right now, so let's go.
Instead of John and Gary. Yeah. those models don't necessarily change due to the feedback they get from the environment. Those models just change.
I will have to push back on you now, though. Because, one, it depends on which models you're talking about.
That's why
about,
I said
right?
Necessarily.
So you've it certainly ain't heard a lot about
necessarily, so.
Maybe some of the other models John has worked on. But, you know, particularly one of the models we're working on right now certainly does. I mean, that's
well,
the whole
your
point
model
is
has
to try to,
to
embody
right?
this process. But, so it does change with input from...
And I will accept that. This wasn't meant as a critique of dynamic field theory or dynamical systems in general.
Oh, no, am I getting defensive? Hold on. I got to step back.
You are getting defensive.
Okay, I got to step back.
You're a host. Don't get defensive.
Yeah.
You could be offensive if you want. dynamic systems models are great, but take a lot of the coupled oscillator models that are really popular. You know, oscillators couple and it's magic, right? And suddenly you have different oscillators for phonemes and syllables and words, and they all phase lock, and it's a magic happy land, and speech is understood, right? Well, why do they do that? And that's not considered, right? How does the organism learn to do that from the environment? That's not considered. It just sort of happens.
Let's bring it all together right now.
That's a good idea.
Right? So let's get off the phoneme. But before we do, I want one sentence from you, Bob, regarding the importance that you think the phoneme has in our fields, in our respective fields.
Well, I think we...
And remember, one sentence, that's all I want.
Can it be a run-on sentence? I mean, I think the phoneme actually is important. Like I gave a talk at ASHA a few years ago. And I used phonemes just to describe the stimuli, right? And Susan Nitrauer, who's a wonderful person and has lots of interesting ideas. Every time I said the word phonemes, she like corrected me. But you don't believe in phonemes. Well, okay, I don't, right? But I still gotta talk about the stimuli, right? So just like linguists, you know, working in Inuktitut or Kikuyu need to be able to talk about what are the sounds in this language, as psycholinguists, we have to be able to talk
and it gives us
and
a way
build
to
our
do
stimuli,
it.
Right?
Yeah,
we need that, sure. Right? But I think it goes deeper than that. In speech perception, I've spent a lot of time saying there's no such thing as a phoneme. In development, I said there's no such thing as phoneme, right? But, you know, development's complicated, and speech perception is complicated. And there's not just, like, one route by which you access meaning from sound anymore. I don't believe that anymore. I used to. I used to want parsimony, right? People do a lot of stuff with sound. They do it all the time. And so even though if you don't need a phoneme to recognize words, and maybe you don't even use your phonemes to recognize words, actually phonemes are something like it, some kind of category or some kind of representation of sound that doesn't have any meaning. It could be darn useful when you're like learning to read, right? It doesn't have to be a phoneme, but being able to think about sound in the abstract is kind of helpful for like, you know, if you're a six-year-old and you're trying to say, hey, you know, this letter means something, right? Well, it means ba or it means sha or whatever.
Yeah. So you've gotten over your rebellious days, and
yeah,
now it's like, you know,
I'm just going to have rebellion about other things.
Right. Well, no, with
phonemes.
Regards to phonemes. Yeah. And you see the value from a descriptive standpoint.
It's truly valuable
standpoint.
From a descriptive
it helps
standpoint.
Helps us talk about it and then
And it,
you
there
know,
may also be
that.
Some a sort of non-meaningful representation of sound somewhere in the brain that is useful, right? It's useful for reading. It's useful for
But let's abstract
speaking.
This
but
out a little bit. You know, for people who are listening, and you know who you are,
yes.
Who actually
on.
Don't care about phonemes. What is why if you care about
Raising
development,
my hand on that one.
If you care about development more broadly, if you care about language more broadly, what is this? Where's all this going? What does this matter for understanding the bigger picture?
Well, I think that's where I started with this. I didn't want to debate you on the phoneme, Eric. You would win that debate.
He's been gearing
up for this
for
months. I was trying to
debate
you on the phoneme, but I guess it didn't really work that way.
Well, I took the bait, or the paid, or whatever.
Yeah.
But
only partially, but yeah.
I think
what's at stake here?
What's at stake is do children
what's the point, back then?
Do children learn the parts and then the whole, or do they learn to do shit, right? Do you, like, sit around, okay, I mean, is language development like learning to read? Well, first you, like, memorize all the letters. And then you memorize the sounds. And kids have no idea why they're memorizing the letters. They're just singing the damn song, right? Kids have no idea why. They're like, okay, whatever. I'll sing the song because mom told me.
So in the context of development, like, it really doesn't matter. But the point being that it just gives us a helpful way to kind of characterize and describe
some of those. It matters a great deal is what I'm saying, right? When we talk about whether and when children learn phonemes, right, we're assuming this kind of bottom-up model of learning, right? That you learn the parts, and then you build up from there, right? And you don't know why you're learning the parts. The brain just does it because it knows it's supposed to somehow, right? Oh, yeah, cool, I'm a three-month-old. Better start learning phonemes. Might need them in, I don't know, 12 more months, right? Okay, that's ridiculous, right? And when you start to think about this sort of phonetic learning in infancy, that's the model you're assuming. Why would the brain do that? Why would organisms do that, right? Now, that's not to say that babies don't start to learn at this age, but I don't think we want to put the primacy on learning the phoneme. They're learning to try to discriminate meaning. They're learning that there might be patterns that recur, right? That whenever someone says this pattern, it sounds like banana, they've got a banana near them, right? And whenever they say something else, they'll get something else. And so it really changes the developmental problem from how am I going to learn to understand speech in general? And then as part of doing that, maybe it would help if I broke the speech down into parts. Yeah. Versus...
After the fact. Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. And this is all happening at the same time. And there's some lovely computational work showing that you actually learn phonemes better and faster if you're learning meaning at the same time. Right. And that suddenly changes the whole story. It suddenly changes.
Well,
just like
it sounds like the problem. I mean, it sounds to me, as an outsider, that part of the what's that?
No, sorry.
It sounds to me like you were talking to yourself. I was worried about you. It sounds to me like part of the problem is that is this sort of disciplinary attitude. Like, I mean, if you're not going to say there's such a thing as a phoneme, I might say that there's no such thing as or should not be a thing as the field of language. And the problem is that we're treating language as an independent thing. So show me anything else, any other skill, any other thing that we do in which we learn it by breaking it down into parts. I know that there are people who try to teach you how to dance by breaking it down, breaking everything down into small bits. I don't know how effective that is. I remember trying to be taught how to hit a tennis ball,
yeah,
by breaking or serve a tennis ball by breaking every motion down into its component parts. That's not how you learn to move.
Kind
That's
of
not how you learn to do anything. Right?
It's kind of like the explicit versus implicit.
Yeah.
Approach, right?
Well, I'll tell you a skill.
Is that a reasonable analogy?
Learning to read, right? I mean, that's how we teach kids to read, is we teach them the parts.
How's that going?
Actually, when you compare curricula like phonics that stress the parts versus curricula like whole language that don't, phonics wins every time.
Yeah.
Hundreds
yeah.
of studies.
Does that work against what you're arguing for here?
Well, that's the thing, is it does and it doesn't. So that actually might be a better way to learn language. But that doesn't mean that's what children are using. And I think that's why kids take 18 years to learn bas and pas.
It might be a better way to learn how to read. But
right.
to learn language, if we're talking about how important context is and that you're just hearing these, streams of physical events that are going on in the environment, then you're not learning by the individual parts and then sort of putting them.
Well, reading is special because we have these individual parts. They're called letters, right? And speech does not. The input to speech does not have. So it might be that that's a system that's sort of perfectly geared for that. Now, I want to say, though, that actually I do agree with you even in the context of reading, Mark, that by getting kids to try to think about the parts, we may be doing them a disservice. We may be better off trying to think about reading as more of a motor skill, as a procedural learning system. And this is some of the work that Elliot Hazeltine and I do, is to see, well, what principles of motor skill learning could help here. But we do know if you take the broadest possible brush that the parts approach does work, and it works better than the throw them in the deep end approach. Now, that doesn't mean there's not an intermediate approach that would be far better than both. I suspect there is, and we haven't figured it out yet.
Presumably, that's somehow... The fact that reading is a relatively late, component of human behavior, and language, spoken language, goes back far before reading.
Far before.
And before that, communication of non-linguistic types far preceded that. Presumably there's some importance for how ancient some of these things are and the systems that are supporting it. I'm not arguing here for modularity, but I am arguing that, some of these things are, reading is a relatively recent skill.
It's extremely recent, a couple thousand years, right? What about music, Mark? You're a drummer, right? I mean, so when I was taught to play the piano, I was taught in little parts. I did my right hand for a while, did my left hand for a while. I did the first three fingers for a month, and then I did the fourth finger, right?
Yeah.
And if she had thrown me into the Moonlight Sonata, I would have been done for, right?
Right.
I needed the parts, and I needed to learn the sort of units, the whole notes and the half notes and so forth. And there's lots of people who are taught by ear as well, who teach themselves, and they'd probably do just fine as well. But But I don't even know how drums are taught, right? That's a totally different kind of instrument. But I wonder if music is one of these domains that it's kind of relevant.
My guess is you probably would find that the best drummers are those who are not taught, that they grow up in a drumming culture and they're hearing it and they're doing it and it's all from, and there's no rote instruction. I can tell you that, you know, when you do learn drumming in a drum instructional sort of a way,
yeah,
you start off with the rudiments, you know? You start off with your
Let me guess.
Boom,
yeah, more cowbell?
Linguistics. I mean, that's the same idea.
Do you learn more cowbell first?
No cowbell. But what you do is like my favorite one, you know, it is like I do this in class. So you do like your classic right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left. Harder than it sounds, but then you add in right, left, right, right, left, right, left, left. And you do that. Right, left, right, right, left, right, left, left. That's called a paradiddle, okay? Now you say, well, what can you do with a paradiddle? Well, you can do it real slow. I don't know if you can hear that.
Yeah.
Right. But then you can take your right hand and you can do something else with it and go like, right, so you have different sounds. Then you can move it around. So you take the rudiment and you learn over time how to take that basic process and transfer it to different parts. And all of a sudden you can't even hear the paradiddle anymore.
Yeah,
it's happening so fast and it's moving around the drum set so much.
Yeah.
But that basic building block approach does work. But does that make me a great drummer?
No.
No. It does not.
Yeah, it just
every
makes you an average drummer.
You've had an excuse, so I'll never be able to tell you.
No. But that's a really good... So that makes you an average drummer. That makes you... I'm not talking specifically about you, Mark.
I love phonemes.
Come on, man.
Oh.
You know I love you, Mark. I'm not talking about you, Mark, specifically. But that would make a person an average drummer, right?
Not necessarily, but it would not make them special.
So in my own – okay, sure. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Nothing special. So in my own experience, I first learned how to play music by ear, and then I tried to take lessons – where we would break everything down and I would try to read music and it was the biggest waste of time that I ever embarked upon. And I think part of it is because when you're thinking of something that is supposed to flow and supposed to be seamless, and then you try to exert some sort of control in thinking about the categories or by thinking about the parts of it, you're just going to interfere with the process of letting it flow and letting it come out. And I think language is the same exact thing.
All right. So I have two critiques of your point. First of all, in many types of skills, you're exactly right that if you start to think about it, it's going to interfere. But on the other hand, if you don't think about it, you'll never get off the ground. Right. So there's I don't golf. I'm a sailor. I hate golfing. Golfing is like what other rich people do. I'm not rich, by the way. I sold the boat a long time ago.
But you just called yourself a sailor, you
yeah.
know? So.
Yeah, I know. I don't have a boat anymore. It's embarrassing.
Wait, what are you, rich or a sailor?
I'm neither of the above. I'm a former sailor back when I was a graduate student. And we hated the golfers because they wouldn't join the yacht club. And I got in
for the yacht club.
Yeah. I know. Okay.
This whole story is
going nowhere
apart.
Good, right? Yeah. But like,
yeah. You're like talking to two Jews from the East Coast, we're not going to look favorably upon the yacht club. But yeah. Go ahead.
We had Jews in our yacht club.
Really? There were Jews allowed in there?
There was one.
They're swabbing
was
the deck. Okay. Keep going.
No one ever swabbed my deck. But look, if you set someone up and say, hand them a club, right? And you swing and say, okay, now you do it. They're going to fail, right?
Yeah.
You got to say, no, you hold it here, you stand here,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So they need that explicit knowledge to kind of scaffold themselves to the point where they can then do it automatically, right, where they can do it over and over again. Now, some people get stuck on the explicit knowledge. We had this great captain in a national regatta once who was completely stuck on this. He would talk out loud to himself about all the strategies and the tactics, and he would think out through all these decisions, and he would get beat every single time. We were 49th in the nation out of 50 boats because he would think about it too much, right?
Because of him, huh?
And it's how you get taught. You're like, well, if the wind's blowing this way, you do that, and you do that until you're done and you feel it, right? And then the sailors who could just feel it, and we had the luck of sailing with some skippers like that, they were like, what are you doing? Why are you going over there? It's like, oh, the wind's better. I can just tell. And you'd win the race, right? Because they can feel it. But if you don't have that explicit scaffolding, you can't get off the ground in a lot of cases.
Yes, but I would also – so going back to –
But you have to abandon it. Babies get off the ground.
So
in terms of speech, I mean.
Some of them.
But going back to drumming, there's a really interesting process that goes on, and I don't know if this is at all. I think it probably is relevant, you know, and I think we've talked a little bit about the role of the cerebellum. I mean, the automaticities in language are have to be important and are probably playing a huge role in speech production. They have to. I really believe that.
It's a motor skill.
It's a motor skill like anything else. But what happens, what's really interesting, what happens when you first learn a complex rhythm, just talking about the two hands and leaving the feet out of it, is that it is by rote. I mean, you're literally learning like, two hands together, one by itself, then the other one, then the two hands together, and then the other hand goes by itself, and then two together twice in a row. And you do that, and initially you're like, that's how you're learning that process. And then, and maybe sleep plays a role in this, you know, this consolidation of this thing. But I know the last time I was doing a samba beat and tried to do it with my two hands on the congas, you know, there is this process that happens where it's painful every day. It's barely getting better. And then one day you wake up, and you go back, and it's like, and you're not even thinking about it. And as soon as you do think about it, boom, you're like a car wreck.
That's the day where you can get a frontal lobotomy and still play the rhythm.
Probably.
Right? You've offloaded it, right?
But that process is real. I've seen that over and over and over again, and every musician who ever does anything like that knows that feeling.
All
right,
right? But I agree with you, and I think a lot of skills do need that explicit process. That's a really great example. But let's go back to Eric, who apparently rejected formal instruction for guitar playing, right? Okay, why did you?
I rejected formal instruction.
Yeah, you thought it was stupid, right?
People who were helping me, you know, showing me chords.
But
and
you
showing
thought it, you thought it was stupid, right? You didn't like it. It wasn't fun.
I was psyched about it initially, and then I realized
just
that
come
it
on,
was stupid.
Just, yeah, okay, good. Yeah. You'll admit that, right?
Yeah.
So this is the point about development. So when we go to learn music, we want to learn music. We're motivated to learn music, right? And even then, the learning by building blocks part for most people sucks. Now, some people force through it, right? They're like, okay, I know I have to do this. They have the motivation. They have the inhibitory control. Say, I got to do it anyway, right? Because this is how I'm good. I wish I had, actually. I'd be a better musician if I had done that, but I didn't. I quit in 4 years. I was like, this sucks. I'm just like you. Now, think about that from the part of a baby, child, right? Child's come in this world. They don't necessarily know they have to learn language or want to learn language, right? And learning about bas and pas sucks. It's like learning your scales, right? And it's not even the pentatonic scales. It's the cruddy scales. It's the major scales. It's the Aeolian mode and stuff, right?
But they're not learning bas and pas, though. They're hearing speech in the environment.
That's my point.
And somehow extracting bas and pas, and I think that's
where things get hazy. My point. If we think about the problem as learning bas and pas, we're like you in music class, right? Children don't have the motivation to do that. There's no reason for them to do that, right?
Because our world is not structured around music the same way it is around language.
Well, that's right, and... And nobody, unless they have some inherent, you know, pre-existing desire to learn a certain skill, is going to put up with learning it that way.
But if you had to play the guitar in order to survive, eat, mate in your environment, everybody's going to learn how to play the guitar. Everybody's going to do it very well, and they're not going to speak at all because all communication is via guitar. The thing is that our world is
Wow, so what a world you've painted.
So that's a bold assertion. Yeah. Could In a completely different environment that was musical based, right, and not vocal language based, would kids learn how to play instruments as well as they learn how to speak a language?
Absolutely, right?
You have no question about that.
No, I mean you can see this not in music, but I mean take locomotion, right? We're walkers and drivers, right? And some of us bike. You go to Holland, every single person bikes. By 5 years old, those kids are better bikers than most of the kids around here, and all of them can bike. All of them, right? It's just part of the culture, you know. Island people swim. They swim. All of them swim. Lots of people here don't swim, right? And those people are great swimmers, I assume. I don't know. I don't get to go to the islands much because I'm not rich and had to sell the boat. But
why don't you take your yacht down there, Bob?
The yacht. We'll go down to the Iowa City Yacht Club after this. But my point is that I think Eric's experience learning music is informative for development. Kids, I don't think, come in knowing what's expected of them. Like Eric knew he wanted to learn guitar. Kids don't know. They don't know that they're going to be in a culture where everybody does music or everybody speaks or everybody swims, right?
And in all fairness, part of the desire, though, to learn how to play guitar was really in some ways to mate. because I was trying to play guitar to get
girls.
But
you
yeah.
really
okay, go ahead.
You really
yeah.
should think about the piano.
That is, well, you can tell if you play drums, you're not in that. Yeah, that's not what you're doing it because it's completely ineffective.
Yeah, but
first
some,
of all,
no,
you have
no,
to,
no,
you
no,
have to travel. Yeah, it's really it's hard to travel.
I had to carry drums around for a long time.
You cannot play a romantic melody on the drums. I've tried. It's impossible.
But the thing though with the drummer,
you've
is
tried.
That they always got the girl though.
No, drummer.
They spontaneously
all
combust.
My drummers no. was, were
that's,
the ones
that they died.
Eric,
they died.
Oh,
they
Eric died that's a death. Speech perception error. The drummers always got the gear.
I'm telling you.
Not the
not
girl.
The girl.
I'm telling
girl,
you. My
gear.
Experience, it was always the drummer.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Wait, are you saying
well, we
that,
played good music,
that,
but yeah.
that as a guitarist, you versus the drummer, and the drummer would get the girl?
Always.
That says something about your guitar playing.
Yeah, that really says something about your guitar playing.
It might say something about my guitar playing. It might say something
look,
about me. It might say a whole bunch of
enough
things.
Enough about yeah, the drumming. Here's the point. You started off motivated. You knew what the goal was, and you still didn't want to put up with learning by parts. Children don't know what the goal is. Right? I mean, as you showed in your book, Freaks, children don't know they're supposed to walk, right? They might be supposed to locomote with their hands. They might be supposed to crawl. They might be supposed to do whatever. They don't have a goal in mind. And if you don't have a goal in mind, why would you put up with all this meaningless stuff, with learning phonemes or learning to move your legs in an oscillatory pattern in just the right way, even though it doesn't seem to be getting you anywhere, right? And so the musical instruction is I think, a really powerful example for teaching us what development is not, right? That's goal-driven. And when it's goal-driven, you're willing to do stuff that you wouldn't be willing to do otherwise. And so conceptualizing development of general abilities like walking or seeing or speaking, those are completely different because the children don't know in advance. They don't come into the world knowing that if I could just learn to speak, I could finally get fed, right? They're experimenting. It's trial and error, right? And they're not going to bother learning the steps to get to the end. They're going to learn the end. They're task-driven, not step-driven.
So you're saying it's random, though? Sorry, Mark.
It's not random. No, of course it's not random.
Right. I mean, I figured you weren't saying that, but it almost sounded like that's what you're saying in that, oh, you know, they don't know what they're doing. They're just sort of doing stuff, and then they figure out they make these associations.
Well,
is
no,
that what you're saying?
I mean, well, take speech production, and you know this literature better than I do, right?
I don't think so, but yeah, okay.
No, I think you do. But kids, they're not producing every possible phoneme, right? They're not producing every possible thing with their mouth. There's actually a fairly constrained set of sounds they make. They flap their jaws, and when you flap your jaws with not a lot of tongue control, you get things like ba, right? You get things like d, because that's where your tongue happens to be. And a lot of other sounds you don't get, right? And from that random but very constrained activity, right, they start to explore the space. They mouth stuff that creates different sounds and so forth, right? And so it's not random. You're always starting from the capacities you have. But it's not like kids are saying while they're doing that, well, what I really need is a repertoire of maybe 40 to 50 phonemes to construct words from.
No,
and
not
I'm going
to,
right?
They are
they don't know where they're going.
Well, so they're not saying, oh, I need a repertoire of however many phonemes. But they are in some ways like trying to do something in terms of communicate with their mother or father or whoever else is. They're trying to do something.
They're trying to do. I don't say they're non-intentional. I mean,
right.
They might even
yeah,
just
yeah.
be trying to
that
get more.
That's what I mean.
I mean, they might even be trying to get more boss, right? I mean, they hear, oh, wait, when I do that, I get this cool sound, right? It might just be novelty at first, right? But that doesn't serve the goal of learning a phonology. That's just the goal here is either detecting novelty or getting mom to smile at me, right?
So,
that's the goal.
Okay.
And then structure comes from that. So you put the emphasis on the goal first, and the structure follows. It's a very functionalist approach.
I would feel bad if I didn't ask then this question. I mean, ultimately, Bob, is there anything special about language in the sense that a follower of Chomsky would say that there's something special about language? Or is it just another domain general skill that we have and, you know, we figure it out because our world is constructed around it?
Wait, so do you want to know what the follower of Chomsky would say or what I would say?
I want to know what you think. I think I know what a follower of Chomsky would say, but I want to know what you believe. Are there any predispositions in the system, and to what extent are those predispositions like, how large are those predispositions for language?
I don't even know what a predisposition is in this case.
Okay.
I don't think that...
Fair enough.
That, you know, because, look, if you take what the Chomskyans say is important, and I don't personally agree with us entirely, but I think they raise a good point. What's important is pretty sort of deep properties of language. The fact that it's a symbol system, you can refer to things that aren't present, that you can manipulate the rules in arbitrary ways, that the rules are different from the meaning of the sentence, that those are sort of independently instantiated, and that they're recursive, right? One rule can include another rule, and you can go all the way down, turtles all the way down, right? So those are actually things that children's language doesn't have until they're like three or four, many of those things, right? And so you want to talk about predispositions. Well, I mean, that's a late period to have a predisposition.
If I can insert this, well, you know, people talk about maternal instincts, but obviously the maternal instinct, whatever that is, and that's a whole other podcast, that cannot be expressed until somebody's of reproductive age. So the idea that things can be instantiated late in development, late in life, that does not necessarily argue against its being
instinctive. Argues against calling it a predisposition or an instinct, right? I mean, take maternal instincts.
Well, you could have a predisposition that puts you on a road to ultimately having this final outcome.
You could, or you could say that, look, this disposition kind of arrived just at the nick of time, that maternal instincts, you know, are enculturated, and people don't learn them until they're adults. Right, from other moms, from their own moms.
Oh, that's
right?
A whole other discussion. So
well,
let's
of
get
course,
back to language.
But that's just not a predisposition.
I was just putting that as
right?
an example to say that you can have late arriving skills that are adaptive and important, but they're not shown earlier.
Absolutely, I'm fine with that.
I would like to get back to Mark's question though, in like a short sentence or less. Not going right to you, pal.
No, he was about to say, does he? But yeah,
is it? Oh, is that where you were going? Is it special? Is language special?
That's it. We'll say it in stereo so you can.
Right.
Is this special? Are you gonna? Is this?
Let's try that again. Ready? One, two.
Is this getting?
This is not church language.
Is this getting broadcast in special? Can I do like a Leslie Box effect if I talk like this?
You can do whatever you want.
This is pretty awesome.
You have to answer the question.
I think language is different. I think language is bigger. And here's what I mean by that. I don't think that language necessarily has anything that you couldn't find in a non-linguistic skill. In fact, I mean, if you look at the last 10...
It doesn't have anything. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
I want to make sure that we're being very
bold.
No,
I'm being very clear, and I'm making a bold assertion here. Okay, yeah. If you look at the last 10 years of animal learning work, right, all of these like core properties of language, like recursion, right, or the ability to have a rule that's symbol-based and not just purely based on co-occurrence. Animals can learn some of this stuff, right? I mean, Tim Gentner's stuff is really interesting, Robin Murphy's stuff, Ed and my stuff on word learning, right? You can see now none of these language animals speak, right? They're dumb. They're worse than babies. Right? These are not intelligent. Well, okay, that's a good point, but they're close, right? You're on the same tier. So nobody's claiming these animals can speak, but when you start to peel off all the things that like are supposed to make language special, animals can do most of them. And the ones that they can't
do
yet.
Can they do them together?
No, they can't do them together.
Not. They can't do them together.
Maybe some of them can, right, if you start to test them in the right way. But that's not what language is all about, right? And language is about communication. And so far, pigeons don't like to talk to each other that way.
But animals communicate in all kinds of interesting ways.
They absolutely do. And not in the way that we do. That's more power to them. Like, maybe the way we communicate isn't that great.
It works for them.
Works for them, exactly. But what makes language special? Or bigger?
Wait. So it is special?
No.
It's bigger.
Okay.
Right?
Got it, yeah.
You know, there's lots of behaviors that are taught and that are culturally passed down, right? There's very few behaviors that take so many diverse forms in so many cultures, right, that with such richness. Like, why would people bother marking their R's for where they come from? Why would people who identify with the gay community articulate their S's differently? Why? Who knows? There's so much richness there, and there's so much diversity across cultures. I mean, why would you put subjects before verbs in one culture and verbs before subjects in another culture, right? So the opportunities for
obviously
cultural...
Obviously, grammar's not that important.
Yeah, obviously, right, exactly. These things are very flexible, but the opportunities for cultural evolution and culturally guided development are tremendous in language. And that's not to make it different from anything else. I think these are the same forces operating. It just seems to be a lot more of it, right? Or take, you know, motor control. Well, I can play the piano pretty fast. You can drum pretty fast. I don't know about you, Eric. You didn't take a lot of lessons, so maybe you're okay at the guitar. I'm a pretty good sailor. I can walk. There's very few motor skills I possess that parallel the number of muscles and the timing involved to make speech, especially at the obscene rate I talk, right? Sorry, Gary and John, if you're listening, right? And so this is like the same problem, but it's bigger, right? or the structure of knowledge. I mean, we look at in memory and categorization, we have all these hierarchical structures. You've got superordinate categories and basic level categories and so forth. And in memory, you've got, you know, different memory stores for various different types of knowledge, right? None of that compares to the richness of syntax, right? Even if you don't believe in syntax, the syntactic or the grammatical structure of a sentence, you know, whether or not that's in the brain or that's just a nice way to describe the sentence, far exceeds the complexity of those other knowledge systems. And that's not to say that it's special or that it's different or that it's even syntactic, but just the size of it, the scale of it is enormous. Or take the lexicon, right? How many faces do you think you could recognize, Mark?
It's getting worse.
Yeah, okay.
As I get older.
A couple hundred?
Yeah.
Thousand?
What's the average person able to describe?
Actually, no one knows. No one's ever counted.
No, that's not possible. No. But it's going to be hundreds, thousands.
Hundreds of thousands. How many words do you know?
But the thing
tens
is,
of thousands.
Yeah, no, you know probably 150,000.
Yeah, right. But yeah. The thing is,
you're
though,
well-educated. You're a writer. You know, that's amazing.
But
right?
The thing
what
is,
what associative learning or memory problem has 150,000 things in it, right?
But the thing is,
birds
though,
with catching if, food.
Yeah, actually, that's a good example.
We just communicated with our faces, right? And we didn't have something better, and we didn't have all of this stuff over here. And I'm putting my hand up to my mouth right now, if you can't see me.
Do you need a napkin?
Then we would probably have just as many facial expressions or whatever you want to call them.
Exactly. That's
right?
I'm not saying that language is special. Right?
I know.
I mean, take people who speak a gestural language,
bigger.
Right? It's just
because
bigger.
Because that's what we do most often.
Yeah. We as humans have such interesting and varied and creative needs for communication that we've developed a pretty darn rich system, and we pass it down and it evolves and people play with it. I mean, in Korea, they're changing how they make bas and pas just for the hell of it. The young people make their bas and pas differently than the old people.
What's the world coming to?
What is the world coming to? You know, the old Koreans are like, oh my God, I can't understand anything these kids these days are saying, right? But they're doing it to mark their social identities.
Something tells
they're
me
playing.
That the argument, the bigger argument, I know, I mean, so I raised, you know, birds catching seeds. They have remarkable memories. They can remember thousands of locations of small seeds where they've placed them and blah, blah, blah. Okay, so, but that's several thousand. That's not the hundreds of thousands.
That's still
that
an enormous
about.
Scale.
So you're going to say bigger. But, you know, specializations. So the question is whether or not then we're getting into the from an evolution from a comparative standpoint. We're talking now about cognitive biological specializations, right? And so then the question becomes whether or not this amazing ability of ours to be as creative with language and to be big with language is a specialization for language or was simply came along for the ride of having a brain that evolved the way it did for other reasons, that language is basically a byproduct of, or the bigness of language is a byproduct of other things that humans evolved and relative to our brain size. I'm guessing that there are a hell of a lot of people who would say that our brain, part of the reason that makes our brain special is the fact that we can do language, and we evolved our special brain to do language in a special way, and that to say otherwise would be absurd. I'm imagining that people would say
that's
that.
That's exactly
right?
what they say. And they'd say, look, you can put a monkey or a dog and raise them from neoteny, right, in a language environment, and they don't speak, and they don't try to speak, and they don't understand that many words, right?
Right.
They got big brains. I don't know about dogs.
But let's see you try to sniff out an explosive.
Oh, I couldn't do that.
Exactly.
Right? I would just blow up.
That's their specialization.
Right. So.
But this is a discussion.
I mean, that's
I was
not an unreasonable argument
about dogs. So part of the reason why people think that dogs are so bad is because they're raised in our environments. They can't.
They're not very good humans.
They're not. But maybe part of the problem with dogs is not that they're bad at that they're not incapable of doing language. It's that they're being distracted by the fact that they have incredible olfactory systems. Like, imagine a situation where you're constantly being distracted by one set. Like, you couldn't hear anything of any importance because you're so busy just smelling everything. I mean, it could be that specializations are not only good for the things that they're doing, but they also, because we are finite creatures, they're going to distract us from developing other skills by virtue of that.
I think you've sniffed
they also
out.
Don't have the same, like, structures those
well there's just
humans,
an actually paper by Asif Ghazanfar and what's his name, Fitch.
Tecumseh Fitch.
Tecumseh Fitch talking about looking at the structure of the larynx and the speech production system of, was it macaques that they were looking at? And arguing that they have the capacity to produce a lot of sounds.
Well, I mean, in humans who lack the capacity, right? They find other ways to have language.
Did you see that story?
I haven't, but
you should look at that.
Humans who don't have that capacity, they use manual languages, right? They use touch languages. It's not dependent on your apparatus. I think, though, what you've nailed with your smelly dogs, Mark, though, is what we've been missing in both development and evolution. And it's the real-time goals that developing organisms are not trying to develop. They're trying to do whatever seems interesting to them at the time or whatever seems necessary to them.
Smelling poop is what's interesting.
Right, exactly. And so if you're a dog and for you satisfaction is achieved by smelling people's butts, then you have no motivation to learn bahs and pahs, right? And we have all of these theories of language development or other development that are premised on the idea that children are trying to learn language, right? That you learn phonemes, you learn words, because that's your goal in life, right? And we even have evolutionary theories about how various aspects of language evolved that assume that they evolved to learn language. But what if they didn't? What if they evolved to meet some goal in the moment, some here and now need, whatever it was?
Yeah, right? So to go back to Pangloss, it's not the best of all possible worlds. It's just doing the best with what you've got at the moment.
Doing the best what you've got at the moment, right? And that may not lead to the best of all possible worlds. It may lead to doing the best that you can right now, which, like, two bourbons in, that's about what I'm doing.
The best you can was great, Bob.
I was happy to be here.
We hope you had a good time.
Can we do this again sometime?
Oh, I'd love to.
Right. Yeah, it would be great to have you back on.
Count me in.
Yeah.
Next time, maybe with Gary.
And John.
Gary and John and a dog.
Yeah. Bring a couple dogs in here. Maybe some.
And maybe some instruments.
Musical instruments. That's right.
We'll do a jam session.
Yeah, we'll do a jam session.
All right.
There's no limit to this.
Yeah. No.
DeltaCast is the official podcast of the Delta Center at the University of Iowa. The Delta Center is supported by the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences, the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders, the College of Education, the Office of the Vice President for Research, the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, and the Obermann Center. All of the music you heard during today's podcast was written by my good friend Josh Kaufman. Thank you, Josh. You can learn more about the Delta Center by going to www.deltacenter.uiowa.edu, and you can also follow us on Facebook.